If you have a green thumb or have always wanted one, then get ready for Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, along with George Allman. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas, help solve problems, and keep you up to date on the latest developments in the nursery and landscaping industry. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to be here talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden for the next hour. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
We do have a class today in our Poway store, and it's going to be grafting fruit trees with Tyler Trimble. So he's incredibly talented guy when it comes to grafting. So if you have any interest in it or are looking to try it yourself, I would highly recommend coming in. He teaches a very good class, very popular class.
He doesn't give a knife and branches to everybody to do, but he shows on hands on and people can stand around and watch how he does, you know, 3, 4, 5 different types of grafting.
Yeah, I've been amazed at some of the work that he's done. He's done a few grafting things for us here at the nursery, and I'm just blown away that they, because I saw it after he had done it,
and you're like, this isn't going to work,
right. and sure enough, it worked very, very well.
Well, that brings me to something. Do you graft? Have you done any grafting of any sort?
I have, and I actually used to do a lot of it because
I know what you're going to say too, right? The gardenias.
Gardenia thunbergia, when you grow it from seed, takes a long time for a seedling to bloom. But we used to sell them. My grandfather had a huge one in his backyard. So we would harvest the seed pods, take the seeds out, sprout everything, put them into liners. And then as they were coming up in liners, it was my job in high school to graft them all. And so I would go to my grandfather's house, cut all the scion wood off of that, and then take it all back to the nursery and sit there for hours.
So you were grafting thunbergia
onto thunbergia.
Okay, just so that it would produce.
So that it would produce faster. Mm-hmm. And then we did do a little bit of grafting of just regular, of the other gardenias, the bigger, the mystery, the Vichai.
Right.
We did some of those, but the guy that really started that whole thing was a guy named Campbell. And I can't remember his first name, and he lived in Coronado. Mm-hmm. And we used to buy all of the grafted gardenias that he could produce. And then it's probably over 30 years ago, we convinced Monrovia Nursery mm-hmm. to do it, but they didn't have I've tried it and never had success with it, but I've heard that Gardenia thunbergia, you can't grow it from cuttings. I don't know anybody that's been successful.
I've never seen anybody successful. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and by way of explanation, though, the Gardenia thunbergia is the South African gardenia that does much better in our climate.
It does much better in our soils. Right? Yeah. So, when you use Gardenia thunbergia as the rootstock, it eliminates a lot of the mm-hmm. problems that you have with the Asian gardenias on their own rootstock. Yeah.
And those seed pods, by the way, are as hard as a billiard ball.
I was going to ask when he said we would get the seeds. I wanted to know how he got the seeds.
We would take the seed pods into the workshop at the nursery, clamp them endwise in a vise, mm-hmm. and squeeze them until they popped. Broke open. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then once they were open, you had to dig the seeds out and you plant the seeds. But Monrovia didn't have a source for Gardenia thunbergia for rootstock. Mm. So we would go and we would harvest the seed pods and send them to Monrovia, where they would propagate them and then they would graft them. And they grow absolutely beautiful grafted gardenias, the best I've ever seen.
They're gorgeous.
After a few years of production, we were talking to our sales rep and he said, yeah, I think we're going to stop growing these. And we're like, what are you talking about? And he said, they don't sell. I said, if they don't sell, it's because your sales reps aren't selling them.
Right.
And your customers don't understand what's going on. And so they redid their whole program, taught their sales reps what the differences were. And now I think almost exclusively we sell grafted gardenias.
We have a couple that are not, but we sell a lot of the grafted, and we all tout them because of the benefits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That said, the thunbergia unto itself is a beautiful plant.
It's gorgeous.
And
yeah.
And if you're not,
it's big too.
It is big. And if you're not diligent about pruning off the suckers, much like citrus, right? Mm-hmm. We end up with just two, which are a really big Thunbergia instead of a Mystery or an August Beauty. And we can show you that right in front of our nursery here in Poway, because we had grafted gardenias there.
Yeah,
decades ago.
Yeah, you have to be very diligent and keep an eye on your grafted gardenias, because if they sucker, the suckers will take over.
So whatever was planted there, Mysteries, August Beauty, or whatever, are gone, and we have two beautiful,
really nice Thunbergias.
And in South Africa, the elephants love to crunch on those. They're like little hard,
a little hard candy.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hard candy.
I never thought of that. Incredibly tough plant. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to kill. Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. Very interesting. And beautiful single white flower as well.
And very fragrant.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a beautiful gardenia, but it doesn't look like a traditional gardenia flower.
No, it doesn't.
It's almost like a natal plum flower in some ways. Yeah. You know, much larger.
Yeah, similar.
Yeah, a little bit like Brunfelsia lactea. Also, it's very much that shape with a kind of a tubular throat. So, yeah, very cool.
Yeah, so that was a...
So there's your graft, we sidebarred, but that was your grafting story.
Yeah. Okay. And that's the history of grafted gardenias in production.
Are you a grafter?
I am a grafter.
Yeah. Yeah. I do fruit trees. I grew up on an orchard back east, and we had one apple tree of the thousand that we had that was every winter we would just graft on for the heck of it and just had fun with it.
Well, I really tout the benefits too for the California Rare Fruit Growers Association. It's fabulous. And they teach grafting regularly. And they also have a cyanwood exchange each spring, which is really fun. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So as long as it's not a patented variety, then everybody comes in and swaps cyanwood and then goes home and does some grafting.
And it's a great resource for just growing fruit. CRFG.org, if you want to look that up. CRFG.org, great resource.
Yeah, you talk about patented. Yeah, and patented plant. It is illegal to reproduce patented plants, either by cutting, grafting, whatever.
Any asexual reproduction.
That's the term. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's prohibited by law.
Which is different than a trademark plant. A trademark plant, you can reproduce. You just can't sell it under that name. So that's why one of the biggest. One of the earliest trademark plants that I remember was Raphalepis ballerina. Mm-hmm. And then...
Which is a hawthorn, right?
Indian hawthorn. Right. Yeah. Yep. Fantastic plant. Really good plant. But there were a lot of other nurseries that would grow Raphalepis ballerina, but they would sell it as Pink Dancer.
I remember that.
Yeah. Yep. So that was how they
got around it.
Interesting. So, yeah. So... I don't think we have anything else that we need to go... that we were going to go over. Got a few minutes left here, but we'll get right in with our guest. And our guest today is Denise Binias, and she is from the San Diego Beekeeping Society.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me here today.
Well, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Of course. I love coming to the nursery here. I've been coming to the nursery here for years and years, and I have a new property, so I have all kinds of more plants to buy and to do. And looking at all of the orange trees or the citrus trees on the property, we're not well taken care of. So I'm going to have to kind of look at those now in the next month and figure out what I'm going to do with those.
Come to our citrus class.
I was about to say that. I would encourage you to come. I think it's in April. John's going to teach a citrus class. I'll get you that information.
I'm going to have to get there. Yes.
Now, how did you get involved with beekeeping? Apiary is the...
Yeah, so beekeeping. So bees weren't really on my radar. I retired in 2018 from my professional position as a physical therapist, and I was doing some stuff at the house, and I had a friend who came to visit, and I'm all like, oh, so what have you been doing? She's like, oh, I'm a beekeeper. And she's all like, oh, do you want to come and do an inspection? I said, sure. So that was it. I went and did the inspection with her, kept going to inspections, and I started taking classes with Hillary Kearney, Girl Next Door, Honey. And then I got into her mentorship program, and it just kind of went from there. And then I ended up getting involved in the California Master Beekeeper program. So currently I'm a California Master Beekeeper. I've been through that 3-year program and then joined the board at the San Diego Beekeeping Society and was board member, then was vice president. Now I'm president. So it just all kind of went that way. And so I just jumped in, you know, all in, you know, just the bees. I just love it. I love plants. They go together.
Well, I met you probably the first day you came here looking at plants for your, I guess your master's program, you were taking all these notes and diligently, you know, these plants give more pollen. These don't, I need plants that have pollen, because you were doing a lot of research with plants and native bees as well.
Yes. So in 2022, I did my California master project. So I actually worked in out in the field, I like to say. So I collected probably about 1,500 bees, and I went, I had already previously decided what plants in San Diego County around my area, Scripps Ranch, an area that were giving copious amounts of pollen to our honeybees. Mm-hmm. And so those were my plants that I chose for my research project to be, to qualify and to become a California master beekeeper. So I had to collect like about 70 to 90 bees from each plant or shrub that I wanted to collect bees from. So I would go with whoever was blooming and whoever had all the bees on it. I would go and use my net and collect them. And then I would freeze them. Then I would have to take my little scalpel and take all the pollen off. And so I did this as a citizen scientist with the USA Pollen Library Project out of Oregon State University and Mississippi State University. And so they have all my 14 pollens that I collected. And they have done analysis with them, and I've gotten my protein percentage back, but I haven't gotten my amino acids or my sterols back. So my project, I was able to present it to get my title, but it's still not quite fully done. And so we don't know what these pollens are actually giving to all of our pollinators, not just honeybees, but all of our pollinators are foraging on all the plants that we have. And most specifically, 2022 was a year of drought. Mm-hmm. So even though we were in a drought, the bees were collecting copious amounts of pollen from all of these plants in our community. So it's very interesting. And now, so we enjoyed a non-drought for 2023 and 24, but now we're back into a drought. And some of those plants at my new property in Ramona, I have a lot of sugar bushes. Rus ovata, I believe. They all have buds on them. So I can't wait for those to bloom, because I know that's going to be one of the a great source for all of my bees at my property now to forage on. So it's interesting, down here in this area, it's more sugar bushes, which is Rus intergrifolia.
Lemonade berry.
But up there, it's all sugar bushes. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting difference. But I'm still in the same growing zone, so I'm very happy about that, because I still love all my Mediterranean-style plants. I've just planted like 70 native plants throughout my property. So it was a property that was pretty much a clean slate, and which I love, because I love doing all that. And I was able to dig all my gallon holes, no problem. Didn't have to hire anybody to do that, because the dirt out there is actually pretty nice. So, and I actually have a monkey flower that's blooming right now that I had just planted like a month or so ago, because I did all 1 gallon planting. So
very nice. We need to take a quick break, Denise, but we have more to talk about. We have a lot more to talk about. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Denise Binias from the San Diego Beekeeping Society. We've been talking about, we started off talking about honeybees. And during the break, we were chatting, and one of the things that I couldn't quite figure out how they do it, and you had a very good explanation for me, is how you get specific types of honey, like clover honey or citrus honey or lavender honey.
Especially in light of that honeybees themselves are opportunists, right? Whatever's available.
So honeybees are very generalist. So typically a lot of those crops that growers want to grow, they might hire some beekeepers or commercial beekeepers to bring their hives into that crop. So if there's like a citrus crop that's growing and they bring those bees in, those bees are foraging heavily on those citrus flowers, then when they harvest that honey from those hives that they have there, they can actually test it. And if it's the highest percentage is coming from citrus, then they can name it orange blossom or citrus honey. So it has to be in the honey. It has to be the biggest percentage of where the bees are actually collecting from. Because they're going to collect from everything out in that crop area. It might be some blooming plants next to the crop. It might be some weeds that are blooming within the crops because they have a lot of row crops sometimes, to give the bees a little bit more nutrition so that they can get more nectar and more pollen from varying sources, because they absolutely need that to fulfill their needs for foraging, for their health.
They really are fascinating insects.
You're going to say busy, weren't you?
Not necessarily. But I had read somewhere that the majority of bee species do not produce honey.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
and I believe most of the native bees that we have in Southern California are not honey producing bees.
Correct. So there are a couple different species of honey producing bees. So Apis mellifera, which is your Western honeybee, which is what I beekeep with, and they produce honey. And then there's the African bees, they produce honey. Mm-hmm. And there's some stingless bees in tropical areas that produce like this really milky kind of honey, but it's very small amounts. Mm. But really Apis mellifera is the bee that produces most of the honey that all the commercial guys have, or the honey producers use that bee to produce honey.
Is that the European honey bee?
That is the European or the Western honey bee is what we call them. But native bees do not produce honey. I think that bumblebees might produce a tiny, tiny little bit of some kind of honey type substance, but just for their own brewing purposes. But yeah, so honeybees produce the most, and then our native bees. So we'll talk about bee species. There's like 20,000 bee species in the world. There's 4,000 in North America. And then in California alone, there's about a little over 1,600 bee species. Now, out of that 1,600, there's like 1,599 are actually native bees. And there's only one non-native bee, which is the honeybee. So we want to make that distinction, because honeybees are managed bees, and so we can kind of make sure that they're always doing well. But our native bees are kind of out on their own. Most of them are solitary, except for you have some bumblebees that are a little bit social but have small numbers. So it's really, for us, we like to educate, you know, when we're planting, you know, that's why it's important to plant a lot of native plants, because there are some native bees that grew up with those native plants that they need in order to survive. And so in San Diego, there when I was starting to educate, it used to be 650 native bees in San Diego County. But now there's they found over 700 native bees in San Diego County. But with that said, there are some species that they're not finding or that are endangered because of course, people always, we can always help or hinder in a lot of habitat loss with all the growth. You know, growth is always positive, right? You know, let's build all those buildings, let's add all those rows. But what that does is it takes away all of our natural habitat that all of our pollinators need to be sustained.
That makes sense. And we were, during the break also, we were talking about bumblebees in particular. And growing up here in San Diego, I remember as a kid, bumblebees were all over the place. You saw bumblebees almost as much as you did honeybees. And they just almost disappeared for a while. And it's only been within the past couple of years that I've actually started seeing honeybees coming back. Something has changed. The pendulum swung one way and they disappeared, and now it's swinging back the other way, and they seem to be reappearing again.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with our weather patterns too. You know, when we're in a drought, you know, certain flowers only bloom for a certain period and then they're done, and then we have the dearth late summer. You know, late summer, the honeybees are going after hummingbird feeders and stuff because they're just trying to find nectar anywhere, and there's not a lot of flowers. So we always try to educate, make sure when you're planting flowers in your yards to get those spring bloomers, summer bloomers, but then plant some fall bloomers. And if you can have some stuff that's blooming in the winter, even better, to help sustain everybody, not only honeybees, but also all of our native bees.
And that's something I've noticed with you, you know, you shop here regularly.
I do.
pick the time that you're here and I'll say, how are you doing? And you're like, good, I'm getting some summer bloomers, or I'm here to get some autumn bloomers. And that's what you were doing. But you raised a point a moment ago about loss of habitat. You know, we're putting in roads and buildings. And so short of tearing up roads and knocking down buildings, what can we do as gardeners to help sustain the native bees? Well, or I think, native pollinators in general.
Yeah. So a lot of people still have what we call these green deserts. Everybody has this beautiful green lawn, but really it's just a big desert because it takes up so much space. It takes up a lot of water, right? Here we are in drought again. But also a lot of people are pumping a lot of pesticides in it to make it green, to make it grow.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of that grass. Start planting native plants, trees, and shrubs. And that is going to help our native population come back. So, and there's, you know, it's kind of nice to have a little bit of hardscape because you want to take care of everything. You don't want to use water. But again, make sure you have a big pot and a big blooming tree in that pot, right? So you can always add all of that kind of stuff to your landscape. And every little, I can find all kinds of little niche and corners that I can add a plant to on my property. So you can too.
You know, it really is amazing how some plants are more attractive to bees than others. I know we used to, and we still do every once in a while, we'll put in African basil. I don't think I've ever seen it.
African blue basil?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a plant that attracts honeybees.
That is one of my favorite plants, and I have one in my yard blooming right now, and the bees are foraging on it. I have a small one that I took over to my new property. But yeah, so if you want a long blooming plant, I believe because it's sterile, it doesn't know when to stop blooming, African mm-hmm. blue basil. So it's blooming now. Even now, this is somewhat of our winter. It's not quite winter yet. We've had Santa Ana winds. So
it was 30-something this morning. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, I use African blue basil in commercial orchards to increase pollination because the bees will come from all around to get it. African blue basil, well, then they're in my lemon trees. So it's a very good plant to put.
Yeah. It was a couple of weeks ago when my son was in town over the holidays. We went to the Lafayette Hotel out in North
wild?
Park, an amazing place. But it was so crowded there that we had to park about 3 or 4 blocks away. And I can't remember what trees it was that we were walking under, but to get there, but they were dropping pollen and flowers on the sidewalk. You could hear the bees in the tree, but as you were walking down the sidewalk, the bees were on the ground foraging for pollen.
Wow.
Off the fallen flowers, which I don't think I had ever seen before, but whatever tree that was, they loved it. I mean, they were all to the point that they would land on the ground to harvest the pollen.
Right.
But yeah, in citrus orchards when they're in bloom, you can hear the bees. Eucalyptus also are very attractive. Well,
peppers,
to bees.
California
peppers, another one.
All over them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of dark ironbark. Eucalyptus blooming right now for the winter, and my bees are foraging on those. And I ride my bike out in the area, and luckily a house behind us has a long driveway with all these eucalyptus trees, and you can sometimes hear them when you're close enough to the bottom of a tree. And then if you look up, then you can start to see all the activity.
Right.
So it's just the funnest thing to check out all of the blooming shrubs and trees, and to hear the bees and stop and just hear them. It's just a great thing to do.
Now, honeybees are, I guess you would call them social bees, they have a pretty big hive and hang out there. But most of the native bees are not social bees.
Correct.
So it's going to be like mason bees and things like that, where they typically find burrows or places where they can lay their eggs and then
So the honeybee is a colony of what they call eusocial, where they have one queen that lays all the eggs. They have all of the sisters in there taking care of multiple generations. And they can have like 20,000 to 60,000 bees in just one hive setup.
Mm-hmm.
But most of our native bees are solitary. So they're just going to have a queen's going to emerge from the previous year, and then she's going to go and mate. And then she's going to start laying however many eggs she does in either an underground cavity. Is about 70% of our native bees go underground and 30% go above ground in some of those little bee hotels or pithy stems or whatever they find above ground. And then they're just going to lay a handful of eggs and put a little pollen ball next to it so that when that egg hatches, it can eat that and then it can pupate. And then that bee will emerge the next year in the spring when the ground warms up and it can emerge. So a lot, and then except for the bumblebees are social, but they have a very small social unit, maybe 100, 200 bees, and they, again, are in a cavity. maybe a past rodent cavity that they'll set up shop in and have all of their brood and then have their colony going.
I remember. Love ground squirrel burrows.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, another one that they like, which we found out the hard way, was nesting behind the shields of a staghorn fern. Mm. We had one at the nursery in San Diego years ago, and my dad and I and another employee were moving it for some reason. We didn't realize that the hive was, or that the nest was back there. You talk about three grown men running and screaming through the store.
Oh yeah.
That's exactly what it was. We found that one out the hard way. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're talking to Denise Benias from the San Diego Beekeeping Society. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. And we are talking to Denise Benias from the San Diego Beekeeping Society. And she's given us a lot of great information about bees, honeybees and native bees and pollinators in general. One thing that we had talked about during the break, and I had mentioned that I had read somewhere that almond honey is not usable, but then John proved me wrong by doing some research.
I was going to say, I found another site that sells it. And the only thing that it touts on it as far as a concern is that if you are allergic to tree nuts, you may want to not take it. But right. Other than that,
I hadn't even thought about that. Mm. So, but it is amazing the variety of plants. And that was one of the other things that you were talking about was how they see the flowers.
So honeybees have special compound eyes that see the flowers. And so it's on the color spectrum, they don't see red like hummingbirds. Hummingbirds see the red, like you always have the red hummingbird feeders and stuff. But honeybees, they see a lot of the blues and purples and whites and yellows. So those are kind of a lot of the colors that I like to plant for my honeybees. But they see that. And then they also, green is kind of a dark color for them looking down on the landscape. And then certain flowers, the center of the flowers have a UV light coming from them. So they can see that. And it's kind of like their target. And then they can land on the petals. Depending on the shape of the flower, it depends on the color, depends on the scent of the flower. All of that together will attract a honeybee or not. And then also how prolific that shrub or tree is blooming. If a scout honeybee goes out and finds a blooming tree, it's going to grab some nectar or grab some pollen. It's going to go back to its colony and it's going to do a little waggle dance on the comb face. And it's going to give directions exactly to where that source is. And it's going to recruit a couple of other foragers to go and start collecting from that fully blooming plant to bring back that nutrition for their hive.
That is fascinating how they can communicate with each other. They really are amazing. You know, one of the other things that I found really interesting about it, I had an uncle that lived up in Northern California, and he had a couple of hives on his property, and he would keep them just to supply his family with honey. And I remember I was up there one time visiting and he was harvesting honey out of one of the hives and he had it was a hand operated spinner that you would put the frame in centrifuge to get the honey out of it.
Hard way
and
to
it
do
was,
it.
And he never had a bee suit and there's bees all over the place while he was doing that. And then after he was done, he would clean it out as best he could, but there was still honey all over it. And he would just leave it out in the yard.
For the bees.
And I asked him, I said, are you going to clean that? He said, no. He said, the bees are going to clean it. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding. And he said, no, just watch. And so he left it there. And sure enough, the bees swarmed all over it. And we went back later that afternoon and it was pretty much spotless. They had cleaned up all of the honey that was left.
If they smell honey or honeycomb, and you leave it out, it is going to attract every bee from all your neighbors' yards, and it's just going to be full of bees. Yes.
Now, as part of the beekeeping society, there are beekeepers that will come out. If people, they can be a nuisance if they get into an area that you don't want them to be in. My
Your sprinkler valve box.
The sprinkler valve box is a good one. My grandfather had a at his house in Bay Park had some stone plant or some stone benches that were hollow underneath, and they had a redwood top on them. And I remember as a kid one time the bees got in there, and I couldn't play in the patio because the bees were around. But he left them there for I think it was about a month or two, and he did not call a beekeeper to come and harvest the hive.
Or just remove them. So honeybees, we have a very strong feral population that are taking up residence in whatever cavity they can. Mm-hmm. The feral bees are unmanaged bees, and so their form of reproduction every spring is to swarm. Mm-hmm. So they're going to swarm, and they're going to go find a new cavity, and that could be somebody's attic, it could be somebody's compost bin, it could be a water meter box. So we have about 14 bee removal companies on our website that are all vetted, and that they humanely will go and remove those bees for you. For that's their service that they provide, mm-hmm. San Diego County.
Well, that's you talk about swarming like that. So when you see bees out in nature or in your yard, and if you have a population of them hanging in a tree somewhere,
yes,
that's not their permanent home. They're on the move.
They're en route. Yeah. Yes. Right. So they're going to vacate their current cavity. About half of the bees with the old queen are going to fly out, and then they're going to land somewhere. And it's what we call like a bivouac or a swarm of bees. And then they're going to have those same scout bees that are looking for a different forage. Those are going to have scout bees that are going to go out and check out all these different little cavities that are around. And this is honeybee democracy. They're going to come back, and they're going to all do that waggle dance again that I talked about. And whichever waggle dance that they all agree upon is going to be their new cavity. And then they're going to rally up the troops. And then they're going to move from that swarm and go move into that new cavity. And hopefully it's not in your attic or in the wall.
Or in the wall, or something.
Because as they go into those spaces, they're not necessarily wanted in our walls and houses.
When they are in that swarm, that big ball hanging from your tree, they're not a danger.
So they don't have a home to protect. Right. So that is their most docile state. So you still don't want to go stick your hand in there, obviously, but just leave them alone. They'll move on in a day or so. So they don't necessarily need to be collected unless you want to collect them and try to hive them if you know what you're doing. Don't do it if you don't know what you're doing, because our feral population does have some Africanized genetics in them, which are overly defensive behavior. And so there's some pros and cons to that. The genetics for the Africanized honeybees, it has diminished somewhat in San Diego County, but it's still going pretty strong. Those are pretty strong genetics. So it's kind of hard to get rid of those genetics. So those are the bees that we don't, like if you try to hive a feral swarm, it can get very overly defensive if you're trying to manage that swarm. And you don't want to have that in your backyard and have those bees get all agitated and they're just going to fly around and try to sting everybody.
I've seen that.
We do have Africanized honeybee genetics still in San Diego County.
Can you capture a theoretical question here? Can you capture a feral hive and then requeen it?
Yes, you can. If they're small enough, but sometimes it's very difficult to requeen a feral hive. And even if you are successful at requeening it, it can go for a little bit and then they're going to supersede that queen because they kind of want their own genetics in there. So it is very difficult to do that. And that's something we don't recommend that new beekeepers do.
I've tried to requeen. I used to keep bees quite some time ago. Tried to requeen a few times with aggressive hives. They'll kill the queen.
Yes. So,
yeah, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. They'll kill a new queen they're trying to requeen. Yeah.
So you have to do a lot longer of a introduction process. And sometimes you have to put tape on the ends and not let them eat her out of the candy plug right away. Or a lot of times you can split that colony so that there's lower numbers. And then you can requeen and get away from those overly defensive genetics.
Very interesting. I was talking about the Africanized honeybees. Or the African bees, I thought I had read somewhere that they were actually released from South America.
Yes.
They were breeding.
From a
research facility down in South America, which is, I've always found that interesting that the African bee situation actually developed from South America.
We should call them Brazilian bees. Yes. You know, saying, yes.
We're old enough to remember Saturday Night Live, where they would have a John Belushi and the killer bees were moving north.
Yes.
You
know? Yeah.
Yes. Oh, there was horror movies.
Horror movies, yes.
Made about the. I remember I was terrified of them when I was a kid. I did not have a good bee experience as a young child, so that may have had something to do with it. But
well, we were not very bright. I think I shared this with you on the apple orchard in my teens and mid and late teens. We'd get an apple and pound it on your hand so that it was very juicy, bite the skin off, and then rub it on our arm and then go near the hives.
Oh,
and
why?
Because you could. And we get, 20 bees on your arm.
Oh, my goodness.
And then you would just walk away until they all left you and see who could stay the longest. But that was not in hindsight.
That's a new one.
But we didn't have Africanized bees in New York.
So. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
they're only in these very subtropical at the bottom of the U.S. and in Florida. They have to have a subtropical environment in order to survive. They don't want to survive in the upper states where it gets too cold and freezing for longer periods.
No, we have murder hornets up there.
Oh, yeah. So here's a question. So my experience, I have not been a beekeeper intentionally for quite some time.
Yes.
I've been an unintentional beekeeper in that I was getting probably 15 on average hives that would swarm and then move into irrigation boxes or other places at the botanic garden.
Oh, okay.
And so the removal was, I was usually the one to suit up and deal with these. And so my own, unscientific approach has been, it seems that the more aggressive bees were nesting in the ground in boxes.
Yes.
And the least aggressive were in walls or other types of
areas.
That's
a great observation because the behavior of the Africanized honeybee genetics is that they will nest underground, but the Europeans will not nest underground. Mm. So if you are getting bees from underground or even in those water beaner boxes, luckily most of the water beaner boxes are pretty small. So when you pull those bees out, it's only about 4 or 5 frames. Mm. So they're small at that point. So that it's very doable. But if you house those that have been in a meter box and you let them propagate and get into a bigger hive, that's when they show their true colors, when their overly defensive nature comes out. Mm. So overly defensive, I mean, is like if you try to go in and do an inspection and they're just coming at you, like they don't want you to get into their brood box and disturb that, and they're flying at you, and then you walk away and they follow you 100, 200 feet, or you can't even go walk by that hive bees accosting you to sting you. That's an overly defensive colony.
Mm-hmm. I used to have a golf cart station in my friend Brandy at the garden. I'd be suited up and she'd be ready to gas that thing and just drive as far away as we could, as soon as we could, because it's a freaky thing, even in a bee suit, the Africanized bees, they'll come and just hit your face.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And then they're going for your dark, they're looking for your eyes and your nose and your mouth.
Yes.
And they want to get in those cavities.
They can smell the CO2, anything that's breathing. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I shared that with you when we were talking about bees, that we had a very aggressive hive. We took the top off, we're all suited up, smoked it, and they came at us the way you described it, John. And we decided, okay, we'll just take a walk and let them calm down. We walked, and you know how large our yard is. We walked all the way out the driveway in the street, and they were following us and pounding us in the face, just like you described. Yep.
Yeah.
That is a good example of an overly defensive
That was a very defensive, overly defensive
I
hive,
would
yes.
say so. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clementson, our special guest, Denise Benius from the San Diego Beekeeping Society. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Denise Benius from the San Diego Beekeeping Society. We were talking during the break about people that might be interested in becoming, I guess you would say, maybe an amateur beekeeper. And you said
a hobbyist.
A hobbyist.
Sort, yes.
But you said, don't do it without getting an education. And just from talking to you, there is a lot more to it than just putting a wooden box in the backyard and hoping the bees are going to get into it or populating it, you're trying to populate it yourself.
Right. So we would suggest that you come to our meetings. We just had our first meeting on Monday and had—
Hey, just back up though. Who's we?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. San Diego Beekeeping Society. We meet the second Monday of every month and we provide educational meetings with different speakers. And we just had a great meeting with an intro to beekeeping from George Davidson from up north. And so you can come and just learn and get to know other beekeepers and start to know what you should do if you want to get bees, when to get bees, what kind of equipment there is. Because it's a great, fascinating hobby, but there's a lot to it. And I always say education first before bees. Unfortunately, we get people who get bees first and then they try to get educated and they've already like lost a hive, you know, due to mites or whatever. And so it just kind of can be a not a very good ending for some beginner beekeepers. So we would like to always try to educate of what not to do so you can get going in beekeeping and actually enjoy it.
Now, if you get the education and you are considering taking up beekeeping as a hobby, you said there's different rules for just about every jurisdiction, every city, incorporated city in the county, and then the ones that are not incorporated, then it falls under the county's purview.
Exactly. Thank you. So there are many different cities. San Diego County is quite large, and there's a lot of different cities that have ordinances, and all the ordinances are different depending on what city you're in. So just look up what city you're in. You can go to the Apiary County website for that. And then if you don't fall within a city, then you're under the unincorporated ordinance. And so you can have a very small yard, and as long as your bees are like 15 feet from your fence line and they're like 25 feet from the public walkway, then you're good to have bees, like in San Diego City.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
Where I was in Scripps Ranch. Now I'm out in Ramona, so now I have to follow the unincorporated, and I want to have more bees, so I have to be 50 feet from the road, and I have to be like 100 feet from the next dwelling, like my neighbor's houses.
Oh, okay.
And so I can have more bees now. I can have like up to, I don't know, 25 bees, 25 hives if I want.
That's a lot of bees.
That's a lot. Too many bees for me. I've got three. I may have up to six and work with that number.
To your knowledge, are there any outside of maybe an apartment building, are there any areas where you can't have bees in San Diego, to your knowledge?
Coronado.
Oh, really?
The island of Coronado does not allow any bees. Hmm. No beekeeping in the
island.
Okay,
interesting. Hmm.
That is interesting.
Although Except for sea bees.
Those are up at Barbanini primarily. Yeah. But yeah. So with regard to the beekeeping society, is that if you want to become a member, is it a paid thing?
Yeah, so it's just $25 for a membership, or you can have a family membership for $35 for the year, and you get 12 months of education. So there's just a lot of benefits to meeting other beekeepers. We have name tags and with our area that we're at. So you can kind of get together with the beekeeper and maybe find a mentor or go follow somebody in your area. Or, you know, every area is a different microclimate, right?
Well, so we talk about it all the time, right?
In Scripps Ranch or Ramona is going to be different than beekeeping in Julian or Alpine or even on the coast, depending on the temperatures and the flora and all that. So that's the benefit of actually going to live meetings at Balboa Park with us. People always want to say, oh, do you have a Zoom? We're like, no, we're not doing Zoom. People prefer live because it's really a community and you want to go and talk to people and explain things and just give them the ins and outs of beekeeping.
That raises a question for me. If you have a hive, there's a specific amount of space that's within the hive where they can build the honeycombs and create the honey. If that hive fills with honey, do they stay there or do they expand away from that particular hive?
So are you talking about a managed hive or are you talking about a feral hive?
A managed hive.
So a managed hive. So when spring hits this year, that's when the queen starts laying a lot of eggs. And so she needs that one box to at least have brood or all of her eggs and all of her larvae in. And then as a beekeeper, if they're growing too quickly, then we'll split that. So we'll make two hives from one hive. Right. And then we'll add a queen excluder and we might put a honey box on that or a honey super. And they're going to go up there and that's where they're going to deposit their honey. And you could take out those, or you could add another honey super.
Can you clarify though for people when you say honey super, for people that don't know, what is that word?
That's just a box that you're going to put very specific frames in that the queen will not have access to if you have a queen excluder, to keep her out from that box. And that's where the bees are going to bring their nectar, and then they're going to fan that and dehydrate it, and then they'll cap it over as honey. But as a beekeeper who does management, you're kind of always going with the ebbs and flows of the population of the bees. So in the spring, that population is going to increase quickly till midsummer, and then midsummer is going to decrease again to the fall, getting ready for winter. So you, as a beekeeper, you need to understand how your bees are reproducing and when to add more boxes or more frames, and how to move things around so that your bees want to stay with you. They're not just going to leave unless they're overrun by ants or small hive beetles or wax moths. Again, that's part of management, keeping a healthy colony, part of testing for varroa mites and possibly organically treating those hives to keep them healthy and productive.
Now, one of the things you mentioned, a queen excluder.
Yes.
Is it a physical barrier?
It's like a metal, or it could be wood, but it has the spaces that it is. The queen is, she cannot get her thorax up through that. So that keeps her in a certain box. So that's the box where she's going to produce all of her brood.
Okay.
Because if you want to actually make honey and harvest honey, you're typically going to do it from clean frames that don't house a brood in it. So you're going to have those frames above her brood box, maybe sectioned out with, some people use queen excluder, some people don't. Because sometimes if you get a couple honey frames in there, she's not going to go up there anyways. If she has enough space at the bottom, she'll stay at the bottom. To keep her brood in a compact area where they can all be cared for and all warmed up.
Okay, so they typically are living and breeding in the bottom frame of the box.
If you can just see them all at once. Exactly. Don't let them go to the other rooms.
So production is going to be in the honey production.
That's
why
they call
the upper
it the part. Super, because you super it up on top.
Okay.
Yes.
That actually makes it on the second and third floor.
Yeah. Exactly. They make the honey.
That actually makes sense.
And if you want a really
sense.
Big hive, you can have a couple boxes that are going to be brood boxes. But then if you're housing European beans, which are usually more docile than some of the genetic Africanized, they can still get a little cranky and a little overly defensive when they get so crowded. It's like you going into a airplane or airport and it's crowded. You're like, oh my God, there's all these people around here, right? Same thing in a hive, because they're all jammed in there. So,
very interesting.
Well, as we get ready to wrap this up here, we only have a few minutes left. What is your website and what can we find on that?
Oh, yes, www.sandiegobeekeepingsociety.com. And you can find what our mission is. We do a lot of education, of course, for beekeepers. We have our bee removal page on there. If you have some unwanted bees that have taken up residence in your home, you can go to that bee removal page and find a bee removal company that's in good standing with us, and that's registered with the County of San Diego, and they will humanely come out and remove that hive and close it up so no more bees go back in there, and then they'll take care of those bees. Let's see, what else is on our website? And then we have our membership button, so if you want to join. And then we have our events page that actually tell you each month what our meetings are going to be, so you can look at that and decide if you need to come to that meeting. We would love for you to come to all of our meetings if you become a member, because we just have so much education out throughout the year.
Now, with regard to mentorships, is that something that you develop with people in if they come to meetings, or is it something that's on the website as well?
It's not on the website. Okay. There's a few of us that will go out and mentor people. But just coming and meeting people and talking with people, you're constantly getting mentored because you're asking questions and they're telling you what you should or shouldn't do. And then just if you can find somebody to hang out with, is a great thing to learn beekeeping, because there's so much to learn, so many ups and downs with beekeeping. It's like this, it just goes up and down. Like one minute, oh, everything's great. And the next minute, oh no, I got a treat, you know, they're full of varroa. And so there's just a ton of ups and downs. You've got to make sure ants aren't getting in there.
Or honey robbers. You taught me about honey robbers.
Yeah, so there's robber bees.
We had robber bees. We lost a hive to bees. I was working and I thought our hive was swarming. They were just everywhere. And then I realized that there were lots of dead bees on the ground. So we mm-hmm. suited up and we walked into a battle,
yeah.
an epic mm-hmm. battle of bees.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's usually during that dearth when it there's not during, too many flowers.
Exactly yes, when exactly. it happened. Yep. Mm-hmm.
They're the ones with the little masks and guns.
They,
right?
they had lightsabers of some sort, yeah, and they came in. Go ahead, Ken.
No, I was going to say,
Denise has taught two classes for us, I think, over the yes. years here in yeah. Poway. A great class with regard to a lot of the stuff we touched on today: yes. native bees, mm-hmm. Pollinating mm-hmm. Plants available for all pollinators, and the idea of mentorship if you want to have bees.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. She's offered to mentor us, but our bees are gone right now.
Our society, we don't just support honeybees, but we want to support all native bees and just basically all pollinators in general. So a lot of education that we give to our to the community is, you know, plant a lot of blooming plants. Please cut down on pesticide use or know when to use pesticides. Follow labels. Get rid of some of that green desert lawn. Provide some water sources if you have some shallow water sources and put like sticks in it or rocks so that bees can actually land and get water.
We see that very super frequently important. out at our railroad layout. There right. must be some population of bees up in the bank somewhere, because in the summertime when it's hot, there's some rocks that are just above the surface, but they have moss on them, and there's a constant stream of bees yes. back and forth from the bank area over to that rock. And they sit there and drink the water, and then they take off, and somebody else comes back in behind them.
Some of my best pictures are from there of that.
Exactly. And so they instead of collecting nectar or pollen, a certain number of bees will collect water, and they need that water to bring it back. And they put it in every single little cell that has an egg or a larva in it, and then they fan their at their entrance, and they create this air conditioning system because their brood has to be about 95 degrees. So if their brood gets too hot, it will die. So they are in desperate need of water every summer when it gets hot. So it's really, and that's why you find bees in your pools.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. a lot of bees are drowning because they can get in there, but they can't necessarily get out.
Right,
so
right.
if you have another water source nearby, like even a bird bath with some stuff in it so the bees can land, it really helps the bees out a lot.
Denise, thank you very much for coming in for the show today. That was a fascinating interview, and we really appreciate it. If you'd like more information, you can check out the San Diego Beekeeper Society webpage. And you've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back next week with another hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, your source for gardening, landscaping, and horticultural news. Still have a question for the Garden Talk crew, or want to learn more about the show or how to become a guest or sponsor? Send an email to gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. That's gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. Or visit walteranderson.com. There's more professional gardening advice next week at the same time on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery.